Good morning, diners and travelers. Thank you for listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we have a good lineup, don't we?
We do. We do. We have a couple of outstanding chefs from New York.
And some personalities.
A great new restaurant opening. Another one here in our home city of Pittsburgh. And a sweet ending. And we'll save the sweet ending story till we get to the end. And it's all, secret is, it's all about chocolate and how you can learn to make wonderful things with it. So you want to hang on all the way through the program till the end just so you know how to do that too. But let's start off, first of all, with a remarkable lady, shall we say.
Yes, and everybody's talking about Gabrielle Hamilton's book.
It's not just Gabrielle Hamilton's book. She's a very fascinating personality.
She is.
A lot of very firmly held opinions, an excellent restaurant in New York City. Well, why don't we just go to the tail of the tape.
Gabrielle Hamilton's memoir autobiography is called Blood, Bones, and Butter, subtitled The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef. This book has garnered wild praise, such as the comment Mario Batali that he said he would burn all the books that he has ever written pretending to be anything even close to this because he was so in awe of your writing. And I agree. But people don't understand probably that you actually are formally trained as a writer in addition to having the innate ability to write, a talent for writing. So you have a dual qualification here. One, you're obviously with your very popular restaurant Prune, have an extraordinary culinary talent, but you also are a writer. So welcome. That's not really a question.
Master of none.
Not really. That's only two. But anyhow, let's start, Gabrielle. Let's start with the cover, the chicken head that's upside down.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
It's hard to see what that is at first, but there's a chapter in the book in which I kill a chicken with my father coaching me, and it does not go well. It is not one of those clean, one-fell-swoop affairs. It took many repeated blows with the dull hatchet that he gave me, and it was miserable, totally wretched.
Well, yeah, your description of it makes it sound such. This seems to be an image popping up in all of these food memoirs, is people killing their first chicken. Have you noticed that?
Well, I don't read food literature, I have to say, so I didn't know.
Okay.
But this piece I wrote a long time ago, and it actually was for The New Yorker, maybe in 2000, I'm not even sure, four, five?
So you've been writing on and off for a while before you decided to launch yourself into your life story?
I've been writing for magazine and newspaper. And then when I got into the book, I realized I had no experience at all and really couldn't even confidently call myself a writer. The writing of a book is such an incredibly different project, and I faced questions of craft that I had not faced before. So I feel like I started the book not as a writer, and at the end became one, and at that, I would say, a beginning writer. Pretty clearly a first book.
Well,
I'll get better next time, I think.
You do have a mastery of language that's rather unexpected, I think.
That's nice of you. I don't know. People are quick to point out that I have this master's degree from the University of Michigan, and I swear I was digging so hard back into that when I was writing this book, looking for something I could take away from that time, but I feel like I really just learned by doing. I'm not sure what the degree gave me at all. If I had learned any craft, I think I had done it prior to going to graduate school. For me, graduate school is more like a vacation, a kind of incredible relief from all the years of cooking that I'd been doing. You know, much more mild schedule than I was accustomed to.
You cooked before graduate school, and then of course you resumed cooking afterwards, or you cooked during as well.
Yeah, the idea was to get out of this business. I was 35 years old and had been working in kitchens since I was 12, really, as a dishwasher. And I was in danger of living a very unintentional life. And I got a little panicked. So in an effort to pull the car off of the road and take stock, I went away to graduate school and got rid of all my stainless steel and sold my check pants and got rid of all my sort of paraphernalia of cooking. And then I got the degree and came back and opened a restaurant about 11 months later.
Yeah, which, I mean, that takes guts. I have to tell you that I did that. I opened a restaurant without knowing anything about the business,
yeah,
and it was a failure.
Yeah, but you weren't the chef.
No, it was absolutely, it was the biggest failure of my life, but it lasted a long time, but it was a failure.
Do you believe that, in failure? I mean, I think even if the restaurant had closed in the first year, it would not have been a failure. I would have learned something. Or
oh, yeah, I learned. I learned never to open another restaurant.
Yeah. Well, you know, I live by that. It's better to regret what you have done than what you haven't, so.
True.
Now, not a bad way to go.
You sort of explained the subtitle of the book, The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef. How about explaining to our listeners the title itself, Blood, Bones, and Butter?
Well, I certainly have my hands in those things each day in my work life. But I really do handle a lot of bones and blood. There's always some blood on my apron. and at Prune, we do go for the butter. But they have connotative value for me. So I think that I was hoping for the kind of transportive value of the word blood in terms of bloodline and family and clan and lineage. And then bones, I was just thinking of making one's bones and maybe a few bones to pick, but not too much. It's not a snarky book. And then butter was supposed to be all the sort of sweet, good stuff. My kids and some of the delicious food and the new family, like the family I've created. Those sweet, good things. That was
now,
my idea.
Now, you've packed an awful lot of action into a lifetime that's far from complete. So you had quite a lot of material to work with, I think.
And I highly selected. I was rigorously selective. There's so much more. I think people have been commenting on what a personal experience it is, what an intimate experience it is to read the book. And I really have to reassure people that it's a deceptive intimacy. This is really the tip of the iceberg. I have not dug into anything I'm not willing to reveal and preserved my privacy as well as the privacy of anyone I write about. It's hard to imagine if you've read it, but in fact, it's very true.
Do you know Kate Moses?
Only by name.
Well, you never read Cakewalk, her memoir?
No.
Yeah, well, anyhow, you don't have any time to read, I'm sure. But
I do, but I just read literature when I have time to read.
Well, this is a memoir. I mean, it's her memoir, and she throws in a couple recipes, but it's about her life. I guess the cake and sugar stuff is a symbol for the stuff that she was hungry for all the time. But her book is so much more, like, naked, if you know what I mean. So, and I, when we interviewed her, said, you know, the one thing, I think I've had a lot of things happen in my life, but the one thing that I really am incapable of is facing it all with that kind of a no-hold-barred honesty.
Well, I actually did not aim to write so personally. I'm very uncomfortable with other people's too much information, and I did not aim to write one of those highly confessional me memoirs. So it's a very personal story, of course, but I wrote as big as I was capable of. I tried very, very hard to only write the stories and also in a manner that spoke of someone else's story, if that makes sense. But yes, it's my life. That's sort of the skeleton or the narrative that I hung this memoir on. But hopefully when you read it, you will identify and recognize things in your own life in it. And hopefully you don't feel uncomfortable or that it's too much information. I struggle very, very hard to avoid that.
Well, you avoided a whole bunch of stuff. Like, I get people tell me everything all the time. I mean, and the one thing I can't stand is people telling me about their private sex lives.
Yeah, I don't like that either. Me too.
So one person actually said to me, you know, you're really a good friend. The only problem you have is you don't talk about sex.
What's there to say? I used to want to talk about that when I was 20, you know, in great detail, and now I find it, yeah, that makes me uncomfortable. It's like, I get it. You can just say in a few words enough that will make me feel comfortable and relieved to know that you're doing it, that you know how, and that it's working for you, but I don't need to know every detail. I actually love that about Tony Bourdain, that he's not really telling you anything about his sex life, but he'll talk about it in a way that so kind of, it just shows you that he understands sex.
Well, he loves this book. I guess you just recently had an event with him, too. Did you?
We did our opening event. That's right. The book went on sale on the 1st of March, and we did a, I guess that's called In Conversation With.
Okay.
We did an In Conversation event at Barnes & Noble at Union Square, which was so much fun. It was my first, and his 10 millionth. And yeah. I think the differences in our skill set were clear. He's much better at it than I am, but
well, he
had some practice.
He says, and his praise for the book. Magnificent. Simply the best memoir by a chef ever, ever. I mean, that's pretty amazing, isn't it?
I know. I'm so grateful. He's very generous with his praise. People have been very nice. I was very afraid in the beginning. You know, I sent that to him. We sent the book to him long before it was out, and no one had read it. So my fears were high. I thought, this is not foodie enough, nor is it badass or rock and roll enough. It's not literate enough, and it's not memoir enough. So I was afraid that it was failing on all of these levels. And when he sent that blurb back to me, which was actually much longer, as you know, like he sent me a very full email, and that's the excerpt that the Random House has pulled out to put on the book. But I started to relax for the first time in 5 years. I thought, oh, if he can like it, then maybe this is going to work.
So this book had a gestation period of about 5 years?
It did. I think we sold it, well, now it's been out for a while. Okay, so we sold it 5 years ago, and I guess I finished it like in September. I can't remember, but you know what I mean. I was ready for fall, but we published in spring. I have to remember when it ended. But yeah, it took about 5 years. If you include staring at it and having it stare back at you.
Yeah, as a writer, I know that one. I know that.
So, yeah.
So you ran across Ernest Hemingway's White Bull a few times.
Yes, I did.
And has the same issue.
Me.
with producing prose. Me, I don't have the slightest difficulty. It just flows like a river. It's mostly rubbish, but it flows like a river. There is one experience that you and I have in common, and you describe it so beautifully. You stopped my whole idea that I might write a book full of these kinds of adventures, because I can still remember the first morning, woke up in Rome, and Anne was still asleep, and I know she likes to have coffee first thing in the morning, and we were staying at what is now the St. Regis in Rome. It was then called Le Grand Hotel, and it was very expensive. Morning coffee was 30,000 lira, which we didn't have. We were using frequent flyer points to stay there. So I got up and walked down to the street in Rome, and I suddenly realized that I didn't speak a word of the language. So I had absolutely no idea how to buy coffee. I had no idea how to do anything. And you describe your own situation of realizing for the first time that you don't know a word of the language, so there's no way you can communicate.
I love that feeling. It renders you absolutely vulnerable, and you may not rely on all of your, I'm not saying you have any, but haughtinesses or expertises that you must ask someone how to operate the telephone or even the toilet, or how, when you want coffee so badly and you just don't know how to get it, it forces you to be kind to others.
Yeah, I did it all with gestures. And,
right.
And finally managed to get a...
Yeah, but see, to carry it one step further is, it wasn't just the language barrier. People in Rome do not take out coffee.
That's right. See? The cultural barrier.
But I did. I finally found a coffee shop that was, a bar that was quiet enough. There were no other customers there. And the kind man understood eventually what I was trying to do. And he gave me a split-size tonic water bottle, and he filled it with espresso coffee, and then he made a wonderful little twist with a napkin in the top. So for the rest of...
I'm saying, you see the experience it brings you?
Oh, it's absolutely amazing. I carried the bottle with me throughout the next 3 weeks, and I got Anne morning coffee every morning by putting the bottle down on the counter and pointing and saying, espresso, and they did what I asked. They thought I was crazy, but they did what I asked. And your book,
I love that.
And your book is...
Had you spoken the language, you would have strolled into your local place and rattled it off and bossed somebody around a little bit. I'm not saying that you would be that aggressive, but without it, you had to ask for help and point, and then you've never forgotten it. It stays with you forever.
So listeners, this book is filled with literally hundreds and hundreds of those kinds of encounters.
Gabriel, could I ask you... Well, I have two things I want to ask you. The first is, when you write a book like this, there's a sense of relief that you convey something. I mean, what were you most pleased with that you got out into this book? I mean, your passion for food, your philosophy of your kitchen,
Happily, I didn't have a message. So the thing that I'm most proud of is that I did not write essays I wrote stories that have narrative drive.
Yes.
And in particular, I knew that I had to tackle the question about women chefs that I am asked constantly, okay. What is it like to be a woman chef, and where are the women, and what do you think? And I wasn't prepared. There was no way I was going to write an essay about that. And I feel like I answered the question thoroughly merely by telling a story with a beginning, middle, and end, and I don't editorialize. I'm just telling you what happened to me on this one day.
Well, I mean, I tend to agree with you. I mean, I was an early member of Women Chef and Restaurateurs, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I experienced that our sisters can be harder on us than our brothers, actually.
They can be.
Yes. But the thing is, I don't know for sure that what you say is true, that things are just so much better now for women chefs. I'm not so sure it is.
I'm not sure they are either. I say that only in my world that I've
okay.
created does it feel it's like a non-issue, because I own my own restaurant. But
right.
I'm not sure what it's like out in the world, in fact. And also, I mean, I can take it even higher, that maybe in kitchens, or like in my own kitchen, it feels like a non-issue. But of course, if I look in the larger world of, well, how come that guy always gets the James Beard Award and I never get nominated?
Yeah.
Or why does that guy...
Oh, congratulations. You are nominated.
Thank you.
You're
no,
a finalist.
I know. I am. This is my third year, but it was a while coming. Or I've never gotten like the Food and Wine. I'm just saying, sometimes I can see that my trajectory has not been the same as some of my male colleagues. And I don't know if that's my own doing, but it is the one place where I think, well, maybe it's not so great for women still.
Now, let's do this. Before we go, you do have a day job, which we've
yes.
been referring to. You have a restaurant called Prune. Let's just make sure the listeners have...
Which was her nickname as a child. Yeah. I thought it had
okay.
some other connotation.
Okay, well, let's go back to what I was about to say. We should allow you to talk just briefly about that, because we've never had the opportunity to go there. We've never caught up with you, which is something that I hope we're going to be able to correct very soon. But what's the Prune experience like? What have you built?
Well, let's see. We opened in 1999 at a time when menus were written. Each item was a paragraph long and had a lot of description. And the soundtrack was the Gypsy Kings, no matter what restaurant you walked into. And the bread basket had raisin, fennel, semolina rolls, and walnut cranberry bread, and eight kinds of bread. And the guy came over in his Nehru jacket and... stood there very opaquely but politely and offering you the bread service. And then another 15 people paraded past your table. So when we opened, the menu was stripped down in a way, not as severe as it's now become, where people just write three words like chicken, salt. Anyway, so it wasn't quite that pared down, but definitely was a smaller document than what was current at the time. The soundtrack was more in keeping with what I liked to listen to and was not necessarily meant to please the kind of mild diner. So we had Johnny Cash and Lucinda Williams and the Rolling Stones. And the food was professionally prepared in a not uptight setting. Now, I feel like I'm describing to you every restaurant in New York right now.
But at that time.
In 1999, it didn't exist, and I wanted to eat there, and so I opened it, which is really a foolish endeavor, because of course you're just working more. You're not going out to eat.
You're not eating there, right.
But now there's a restaurant like this almost on every corner, so it's been great. Now I can, in fact, go out to this kind of restaurant.
Where's one of your favorite places?
I've had some delicious meals lately. Let's see. I had two in a row at Roman's in Brooklyn. Quite tasty. I had a very nice meal at Roberta's, also in Brooklyn. Amazing. And I know it's not news by any stretch, but the meal I had at Michael White Morea was...
Oh, I love
it. Oh,
him.
Yeah, he's astonishingly talented, isn't he?
Yep, I mean, just amazing.
We went for a Sunday brunch, which you'd think would be the most boring meal of the week, and it was just absolutely terrific.
Well, that's what I loved about it. In those high-end places, usually the chef is holding back and kind of sparing on strong flavor because they don't want to offend, I think, what they perceive as their clientele, which is often maybe quite reserved or fearful of strong flavor. And there it was just balls out, like
yeah.
all that flavor. And I didn't feel annoyed at the price, which I have in other high-end restaurants where it's just so small, the portion. And I find that annoying.
Yeah.
I can eat food. Give me some food to eat. I'm willing to pay the high-end price, but put something on the plate.
Okay,
anyway,
if we come to prune, we won't leave empty-stomached.
No. In fact, I'm always having to learn how to make the portions just a little bit. But I still have an attention span. I have not fallen into the small plates ADD that seems to have taken over the world. I can just have a starter and a meal. That's still satisfying to me. I don't need to have 48 plates of one paste, because by plate, actually, 11, I've already forgot what I've eaten, and I feel sick later.
the last meal we had in London, Henry threw up and reports
the same.
Yeah.
I truly, that's not kind.
Up.
No. So anyhow, well, I think we've just maybe hinted at the richness of this book. You've had a very, very fascinating life, a rich background. Your parents were fascinating, fascinating. Mm. You have constructed a page turner, which is rather unusual for a memoir, especially for a chef. This memoir.
Yeah.
And
I thought if I'm going to ask for your time, I might as well.
Well,
you got it.
You got it. And hopefully we'll be able to see you in Prune at some point. And I really thank you for taking time on this, I'm sure, absolutely maddening book tour.
Oh, it's totally fine. It's not a bad book tour. It's better than working the brunch egg shift, I promise.
Okay, Gabrielle, thank you again.
I thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
And now we'll take a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And next up, there's always a little excitement surrounding Gordon Ramsay. And now we're...
Whether it's good or bad, there's always some excitement there.
Yeah, and our next guest has a connection with him, direct connection with him, and so he can share some of that excitement with us. This is his chef from the London in New York City, Gordon Ramsay at London, Marcus Glocker. Marcus Glocker, is that a correct pronunciation?
Yes, it is.
And it's an Austrian name, and I was first startled that your Marcus, your first name, is spelled with a K instead of a C, and I should have figured that out since you're Austrian. You are the chef de cuisine for the Gordon Ramsay restaurant at the London in New York City. That's an awesome position.
It is. I'm very happy.
So, you've been back and forth with him for a while. You've worked with demanding bosses. In addition to Gordon, you worked for Charlie Trotter. You worked in your native Austria, right?
Yeah, right.
But you love New York.
I love New York, yes. I always actually picked out the restaurants I want to work for. Gordon Ramsay, always liked the discipline in his kitchen. I like his style of food. I like the clean flavors. When I went to Chicago, I wanted to see more modern techniques and a different style of how to run a kitchen and how to run a whole restaurant. And Charlie gave me definitely this aspect of running a restaurant. I would say the American style, and Gordon gave me the
English.
The input in a European driven restaurant.
Right. Now, both of them share one thing in common. They're very demanding, aren't they?
Oh, yes.
Now, I mean, Charlie Trotter is legendary, a stickler for absolute perfection. Is that true?
That's very true. He's very, very anal about little details.
Shall we call him precise?
Precise, of course. He is sometimes something else in the kitchen, I would say, but in general, he's like really just, he's all worried about the food, and that's the main focus, and that's the important thing. It's all about the food.
And his good buddy, Tetsuya, we were at his restaurant in Sydney, and I can see why they're good buddies, because they're meticulous there, too.
Yes.
The exact placement of the dish in front of you, I mean, I accidentally turned it like a fraction of a centimeter, and the waiter was right there putting it right back to where it was put down in front of me.
Yeah, exactly.
So now, tell us about, of course, everybody wants to know about Gordon Ramsay. He has had some uncomplimentary press, but people follow him faithfully in his various TV programs, right?
Yes.
But what's
with Gordon, it's always because Gordon is such a big person in the press these days. I would say it's very difficult to just focus on the food. You always have this side brand of him with the TV shows and how he walks into restaurants and rips them apart. But end of the day, what I always see in him is still, he comes in the kitchen still now in New York and walks in the kitchen and sees things not many people see right away. So he knows the setup, he knows how a station is set up, he knows how people need to work and act in the kitchen. So it takes him maybe 2 minutes to walk in the kitchen and he knows exactly what's wrong with it. And it's, even if it's his own kitchen, he will ask me right away why this and this and this is like that, and he wasn't here for a month. So it's very exciting to see this energy happening in the kitchen.
So even after years of working for the master, you still take direction from him and you still respect his opinion?
Yes, I will always respect him. I mean, he trained me, he teach me a lot, and he definitely told me how to be consistent in a restaurant and how you lead a team behind you and how to make discipline happening in a kitchen, which is not easy always.
I would say he would be. Tell me what, for our listeners who are planning to reserve and come for dinner at the London, what do they expect? It's pretty posh, right?
I would say it's pretty polished. We do definitely a little bit more of a modern approach to the French cuisine. I have a little bit of Asian influences as well, but it is the French setup. You walk in, you have a beautiful canopy while you're looking at the menu. That's normally I like to do. Like right now on the menu, I have a nice potato soup with a pomme gaufrette, which is just crunchy and cooked in a little bit of syrup, so you have sort of a sweet aspect and a nice potato soup. Start. Then you pick your menu, you're going to get a little amuse-bouche, we call it, and then you have your three-course or your seven-course meal. And it's a tiny room, it's 16 tables.
Oh, that's
nice. I have no music in the restaurant because I want to really have people enjoying their quiet time, which is in New York not always the case. So you have really a room where you can enjoy your food, a good conversation, nice glass of wine.
Is that your idea about no music, or does he do that in his... I can't remember about his...
No music is basically in all of Gordon Ramsay Michelin star restaurants,
yeah,
yes.
I can't remember. Okay.
The modern restaurants like Maze, we do have music, and his new restaurants, he will open in London. They're a little bit more casual, he will have music. But all the high-end restaurants, they don't have music.
Okay. Give us some highlights of the menu.
Some highlights of the menu. I just put this dish on the menu, which is turbot. And inside the turbot, we have an organic egg yolk. So basically what you do with the fish, you cook the fish and the egg yolk at the same time. And the egg yolk is still runny inside and the fish is perfectly cooked. And it's sort of a play on a ravioli with an egg yolk inside. But it's basically not passed out outside as the fish.
Uh-huh.
And we have a little bit of champagne sauce and oxtail shoe with it. So it's one of our new dishes on the menu,
which is
very exciting.
Yeah, it sounds great.
How about some more dishes? We have right now duck dish on the menu. We have just a Long Island duck breast, which is rendered down. We have on top some yuzu honey on the skin. The bones we use for a beautiful consommé made with Szechuan pepper and dry sherry. And then we have a little bit of potato rusty and Savoy cabbage. It's very good flavors.
Now, I remember still one dish that we had at Gordon Ramsay, Royal Hospital Road.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Must have been 10 years ago. Venison.
Yeah.
With a chocolate sauce.
Yeah, venison chocolate sauce is a very classic of Gordon, yes.
I can see it now, and I can practically taste it more than 10 years ago.
It was revolutionary at the time, but of course now it's not.
Now many people doing it, of course.
I
have something similar on the menu right now as well, but it's just a different approach. It's a little bit more modern, but I have my own version of Ras El Hanout, basically. That's a spice mix, the best spice mix.
Right.
And I have chocolate in there, I have coffee in there, and I pair it with venison as well. It works really well.
Now, how much say do you have? I don't know quite how Gordon Ramsay works with his own restaurants. Do you all, each individual restaurant, have a big say in the menu?
Yes, definitely.
So does he veto things or suggest
things?
When he
comes in and we have new dishes on the menu, he definitely tastes the new dishes. He will tell you what he thinks about it, if he's happy or not. But we know each other for so long, and he knows my style of cooking. I know what he wants, what he needs. So there's little nuances where basically the seasoning or maybe one element on the plate is too much on, or we add a little flavor of that. It's not like he's going to rip the whole dish apart and say, like, please, what are you doing? It's not going to be like that.
I see. And now you said there are Asian influences. What motivates the Asian influences in your...
This is another thing I really experienced with Charlie Trotters when we flew the fish from Japan from the Tsukiji market over twice a week. And I had a lot of opportunity to see Asian products, and I always thought this element goes really well with the French cuisine. And these days, it's just to make it a little bit lighter, just go away from the heavy cream and butter and all the stuff. So I try to lighten it up with some Asian flavors, and especially the yuzu, or I buy my soy sauce, for example, from Japan, which is an amazing soy sauce.
What is it? What's it called, the brand?
It's a very difficult Japanese name to pronounce. Oh. However, it's a very thick soy sauce, so sweet, salty in the same time, but it's very sweet and thick. So, first of all, you don't need much for the seasoning, because it's such a strong flavor. And you can use it, for example, as well, with mix it together with smoked soy sauce. You just need a little bit of the smoked soy sauce, a little bit of that soy sauce, and put this on a loin of tuna. And you don't have to do much to the tuna. It's just an absolutely amazing flavor. And the products from Asia right now, with yuzu and soy and all sorts of fish from there, is just a very interesting way to combine them with French flavors.
When you were in London, did you ever come across a chef called Jerome Tovron? He was at a restaurant called L'Etranger.
L'Etranger, yes. I never met him personally, but I know of him.
He
was French, but he cooked with an Oriental influence, just like you're describing. I remember the dessert, and Anne almost never eats dessert, was a creme brulee with various different Oriental spices of the non-sweet variety.
Yeah.
That was just absolutely terrific. So you're familiar with the name, but you never met
him. Yeah, of course. He's a very, very famous.
I'm just interested, since you're Austrian, do you have fabulous desserts there? I mean, do you influence the pastry chef?
Yes, we have very good desserts in Austria, I would say. Austria is very famous for their baking and
I meant
definitely.
At your restaurant, do you have the, at the London?
Yes, I definitely have influences in there, because my pastry chef is American, but he trained in Germany back in the time, and so he knows all about baking and stuff. So definitely our afternoon tea, I have some Austrian cakes, but made a little bit more modern on there. I have techniques I use from Austria, definitely go into some pastries. But for me, fine dining and Austrian desserts in the way of making it light and very interesting. I think Austrian pastries are not meant to be like ultra fine dining. It's nice to eat, but
to make it small
and then look elegant on the plate, it's very difficult sometimes.
Now, you mentioned something interesting just now, Marcus. You said afternoon tea. So this is, the London is not just a dinner restaurant, because it's in a hotel. So,
exactly.
So do you serve breakfast as well? Or?
We do breakfast. We do it about average out of this kitchen we have. It's one big kitchen, but it's divided in two separate restaurants in the same way as the kitchens are separated. The middle part is pastry, and then you have a Maze Kitchen and the Gordon Ramsay. So in the Maze part, you do in the morning about 350 breakfast.
Oh, wow.
You're doing room service. You're doing business lunch. And then we serve afternoon tea out of the same area. And then for dinner, we're doing about 120, 130 for a Maze dinner. This is the busiest part of the restaurant hotel, I would say. Gordon Ramsay kitchen, which is just open for dinner, and we're just responsible, or we're just doing the restaurant and the chef's table in the kitchen. That's
okay,
it.
So when you say the Gordon Ramsay, that's Gordon Ramsay at the London, is dinner only.
Yes.
But the dining,
and it's
and
two Michelin stars, I should point out.
Yes, yes.
The Maze restaurant is by Gordon Ramsay as well, but
yes,
it's a more casual part of the of the restaurant. And it's more like people from the hotel coming in, having a quick bite. There's a lounge there where you can have a little bar snacks. You can have the afternoon tea starting from 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And, yeah, you can have late night snacks as well at the bar.
So
you're busy.
the original Maze is in a Marriott hotel at the corner of Grosvenor Square, right?
Exactly.
So the one in New York at the London is similar to that one?
It's similar to that one. It's the same sort of concept, smaller plates, nice, fun food, but it's more casual because I like to have the contrast from to have a nice fine dining restaurant, and then you have something casual as well. So there's something for everybody.
And you oversee that menu as well?
Yes.
You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to try your chef's table. I bet that's fun. Is it right in the kitchen?
It's right in the kitchen. I think it's one of the best chef's tables in the city. No doubt. It's directly in the kitchen. You can't get any closer to the kitchen.
Well, how many courses do you do at Chef's Table?
Minimum is 7 courses I do, but I ended up doing 15, 20 courses for them as well. It's all for me about giving them a good time, and they should have fun. And I asked them if they have any allergies or dislikes, but after that they let me know when they're full or they are still hungry, and we just give them a complete night. Sometimes they are here for 3 hours, sometimes they're here for 5 hours. It depends. People walking around in the kitchen, they can ask questions. I cook with them sometimes. We're doing a souffle, or we're cooking some scallops or something like this. So it's really all about being in the kitchen, interacting with the chef, and just having a fun night.
Is there a minimum number of people for the chef's table?
Normally it's not. I would suggest it's 6 to 8 people.
Six to eight.
Sometimes 2 people on the table as well, but it's a fixed price. So.
Oh, it is. For the whole table, there's a fixed price.
It's a fixed price, yeah.
Okay, and what would it be?
What we're charging is $1,900 for table, which is includes a bottle of champagne to start, and food, and all everything else is on top of it.
And it's all sold out all the time?
We're pretty much sold out. It's like, I would say, 2-3 weeks in advance to get the table. Plus, if the table is available, I always bring somebody from the restaurant in and offer the chef's table to them to just have somebody in the kitchen.
Oh, really?
Nice to have people in the kitchen. So somebody gets lucky when the table is not taken.
And so they don't have to pay $1,900 for it.
No, of course not.
I'm going to do that, Marcus. That's how I'm going
to
get there.
So you have to call up and make sure it's not reserved.
we're going to come on at night when you're not busy.
Can I ask one other question here? One more question is, when you're not working, and because I always love to hear where these chefs eat, where do you eat in New York when you're not eating at your own restaurant?
If you can choose one restaurant, almost impossible to just choose one restaurant in New York.
Right.
I tell you where I had a really good meal the last time was John Dory Oyster Bar, the new John Dory Oyster Bar of...
I haven't been there yet.
Is that right?
It's open, just the oyster bar is open.
Yeah, it was reinvented, right? It was reinvented.
Reinvented in the hotel, and I had a really fantastic time there. It's a beautiful ambience, very relaxing and easy, and the food was phenomenal.
Yeah.
Fresh. The oysters have been out of this world. Every dish was perfectly seasoned. Really, really good.
We have a really good interview with a former partner of John Dory, David Lynch, who's now at Quince in San Francisco. On the website, if you'd be interested in hearing that, I guess. He pairs the wines with the...
Yeah.
He's a sommelier as well. So anyhow, so you like that, and you don't eat fast food or anything like that, because a lot of chefs eat the most awful stuff.
Fast food? Not really. there's always a time and a place.
Good.
For that, but in general, I don't. I really enjoy my days off to enter New York City and see what's new and have a bite to eat in different places just to be on top of it. It's always changing. It's always something new. It's always a new trend.
Yeah, now, you're back and forth between London and New York, do you?
No, I'm in London like maybe once or twice a year.
So, but you're not taking a stand on which is the premier food city, restaurant city, London or New York?
Yeah, London or New York, but I think there's so much information for me in London, and I know Gordon is taking on a lot of new projects in London, which definitely have a little bit of a New York flair, the bakeries and then just the casual side of the restaurant. So,
give and take
between London and New York.
It's a toss-up for me, I don't know. It's really been delightful talking to you, Marcus. I feel like I've made a new friend.
Thank you very much. And a pleasure.
Robert, do you have something else to say?
No, I will just have to catch up, Marcus, and hope to sit at the chef's table and capture a few words on the spot.
I'm really looking forward to that. I'm going to work this one, Marcus.
Yeah, okay, I will let you cook a souffle or something. Please be prepared.
So we'll be in touch, and we look forward to meeting you in person.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks, Marcus.
Nice talking
to you. Bye-bye.
Take care.
And stay with us while we take a short break, and we'll see you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Here we are again, and next up, we're going to be talking to the chef at a restaurant that's a New Orleans restaurant, but here in Pittsburgh. It's called Nola Market Square, and here's the chef.
If you've been listening to On the Menu for the last several weeks, you probably noticed that we've been having a lot of fun right here in our home city of Pittsburgh because we have a whole wave of new restaurant openings. Well, listeners, it hasn't stopped, but now we've got something a little different. We have New Orleans and Pittsburgh, and Andrew Hebson is here to help us understand why. Welcome to On the Menu, Andrew. We're at the corner of Market Square, newly reconstructed Market Square. Does that feel good?
It feels great. It's great to be here, and thank you for having me on the show. And we're really proud of the place and just having a blast doing it. So
it looks a lot better than when it used to.
Right on. Yeah,
when it was 1709 or whatever it was.
We definitely put some effort and labor into remodeling the old 1902, but it's definitely its own character now.
So. But we were talking before we came on the air about Yves Caro and his discussions with the people who owned the building about what kind of restaurant to put in here,
mm-hmm.
and then you I think you said yourself had a role in seeing the space and suggesting what it felt.
The original thought was either a French brasserie or a French bistro, and I was already on board to help Eve open up another restaurant, and I walked in the space and I looked around, and you know, New Orleans has always been a city that I love. I try to get down there as often as I can. It's just a beautiful city, and I looked at the space and it just reminded me of the French Quarter, and after talking with everyone involved, we decided to go that direction, and here we are.
Now, it didn't just remind you of the French Quarter based on one visit, though. You were telling us that you've been a long-time student and a long-time fan of the cooking of New Orleans.
Yeah, definitely. Mostly self-taught student because I have been a fan. I think my love of the city came, you know, at an early age. I spent some time down there when I was real young, and it's you know, always been a cuisine that I've always been interested in. I have always loved Southern food in general. I've always had a soft spot for, and finally here getting a chance to give it to Pittsburgh. So
now there's more than one New Orleans cuisine, isn't there? There's first of all there's Creole, and then there's Cajun, and then there's a whole group of modern chefs who are doing some further interpretations of that. How would you categorize what you're trying to achieve here at NOLA in Pittsburgh?
What I'm trying to do is kind of walk that line between staying very traditional and being a bit of and throwing some creativity into it. New Orleans is a city with a very, very deep culinary history, and I want to pay homage to that, but at the same time, I want to have fun with the food. So.
You want to just illustrate that by stepping through the menu, which Anne is holding in front of you?
Talk to us about some of your favorite items.
All right, some of my favorite items are, of course, the ever-classic red beans and rice. I kept that pretty true to the classic, the purest, simple form of red beans and rice. And then, you know, we move on to the crab ravigote. It's you know, crab ravigote is a classic New Orleans dish, but I wanted to kind of do something else with it, so I took the sauce and spiced it up with some my own little blend of chilies and a little bit of papaya to sweeten it out and just give it a little more character and a little more depth. Then probably my favorite appetizer that we have right now is the Jameson Farm lamb ribs, served with a hot pepper jam. It's and a little bit of Creole slaw. Smoked those in house, and it's one of my favorites.
You have to sign me up for those right away.
Now lamb isn't really a New Orleans kind of meat, is it? So there you've got a sort of a loose interpretation.
Yes, definitely. Even though that's a dish that's very similar to one that I had at a little hole-in-the-wall place down on, I can't remember the name of the street down there in the French Quarter. It's the one that's right in front of the river. Is that Esplanade or is that?
I think it has a couple of different names along the way.
Okay, but it's right across the street from the French Market. Anyhow,
I know where it is.
I kind of forget which street is which, but I can find little spots.
Now, some of your heroes are also some of our heroes, like John Besh.
John Besh is great. He's I really respect what he does, and I've had a chance to eat at Luke, which was a phenomenal meal, and very shrewd, you know, entrepreneur and restaurateur. He's really marketed himself well, and he really does great things for the city and the food as a whole. So.
When the people are jamming in here, I mean, what is the big attraction, do you think?
I think one of the big attractions is the open kitchen. If you turn over to your left, you'll see it with the downlight heat lamps in the window. We have a granite countertop on the window, and it's almost interactive. It's so open, and I think people really I think it's entertaining to people, and it's kind of nothing to hide at the same time. People get to see exactly what's going on behind the scenes. So.
How have you found the new Market Square? I mean, I don't know if you're a native Pittsburgher, but you've certainly been here long enough, so you've seen Market Square on its not so good days.
Oh yes, I remember when it was the Vagrant Central for quite some time. But you know, the new remodeling and renovation that's gone on out in the square, it's really gorgeous. It has a very, very open, inviting feel to it, and with the iron chairs and tables out there, it's really, hopefully, if all goes well, as we've seen the signs for, that it's going to be the next destination spot in Pittsburgh.
Now, will you be able to go outside on the sidewalk in the season?
Yes, we'll have seating outside on the sidewalk,
great. Okay.
And we'll have a full awning, which will roll out.
What's your best recommendation for your main courses?
Main courses, I'm going to have to go with the, well, My two personal favorites are the wood roasted quail. It's served with a oyster, stuffed with oyster dressing, and served with just a real simple wild rice pilaf and cranberry and pinot noir reduction. And the shrimp and grits is Anson Mills stone ground grits cooked with buttermilk.
The greatest, yeah.
And so coarse ground grits, so you get a phenomenal texture out of them. A little bit of smoked bacon and classic sauce on the shrimp and grits. We've also had our grilled catfish has been kind of what the runaway crowd pleaser.
I'm so glad you mentioned it. There's probably only one thing that I totally despise, and it's catfish. And I was very pleased that it was moving on to the endangered fish species list.
It is. I didn't realize that.
Overfished catfish.
I didn't realize that.
Too many of those all-you-can-eat catfish.
We're very sensitive to the environment and our watersheds whenever we're using catfish. It's a farm-raised catfish, but it's done on a closed-loop system that's very clean. And something that we can stand behind and feel comfortable and proud of serving.
Now, it says here, dinner on the square. Does that mean you're not open for lunch?
No, we are open for lunch. We have a separate lunch menu. And our bar menu, our lunch menu goes from 11 a.m. until 3 p.m. And then between the hours of 3 and 5, we run our bar menu.
Bar's hopping.
The bar, you should see it on a Friday night. You got to remember, this is Tuesday. And Friday night happy hour, it's standing room only. It's been quite a blessing to have the crowd that we've had so far.
We're here, by the way, listeners, just in case you're wondering, we are in the quietest corner of NOLA on the Market Square. I did want to include another thing when we're talking about the location, because a lot of people would have considered Market Square practically off limits to moving traffic, which is no longer true, because you can enter on Market Street from Fifth Avenue, mm-hmm. and you can enter from Forbes Avenue at the top end of the square and drive around the square.
Yes. There's actually some limited parking actually right on the square. And it's almost like a European roundabout where they set it up.
But here's the deal. At dinner time, valet parking. Free valet parking.
Yes, we offer complimentary valet parking, which not too many restaurants do, but we're very proud to do it to kind of ease with the downtown parking woes here in Pittsburgh. So,
and that starts at what time of the day?
That starts at 5 p.m.
Well, I don't see any beads around, so I can keep my blouse on.
thank goodness for that.
I will be honest, I have seen some beads fly in the bar area, but I haven't seen any disrobing, thankfully. So.
Anyhow, well, I'm looking forward enormously to this.
Yeah, and I think it might be time to start our evening with a cocktail in the spirit of New Orleans.
You're going to want one of those Sazeracs.
Sazeracs, that's what I was going to suggest.
The cocktail was invented there, so we'll have to try and make sure that you're.
We also do frozen hurricanes, and
it's also New Orleans.
Yes, we do hurricanes frozen up or on the rock. We do the full line of classic New Orleans cocktails. So
yeah, well, they have a museum of the contemporary American cocktail, the museum of the American cocktail in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
Not much of a museum yet.
No, it wasn't.
Don't pay to go.
They're working on it.
They're working on it.
But they're not just working on NOLA, it's working. Packed on Fridays, it's busy tonight already, and it's not yet 6 o'clock, and you don't get busy till the magic dining hour in Pittsburgh, which is 7 o'clock.
Yes. Right around 7 o'clock, we fill up pretty good. So
make a reservation. Come on down, and Andrew and his team will take good care of you, I'm sure.
Yeah, we promise.
Did we cause those people to move?
we drove some people away.
We did. Anyhow, it's great meeting you. Looking forward to the food. Thank you so much.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Andrew. So you can tell that we and everybody else at NOLA on Mark Square was having a fine old time. And now it's time to take a break, and then we'll come back with the sweet ending that we promised you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are again.
And are we there yet, Daddy?
Are we there, Daddy? We promised you a sweet ending, and Ewald Notter is nothing if not a sweet ending, because he's produced the most wonderful book, which it turns out he started out writing as a textbook for a class at his cooking school, but it turned out to be a whole lot more than that, and we found that there was a whole lot more to Ewald than just his book, too, so I'm sure you're going to enjoy listening to him.
Swiss-born Ewald Nader is the founder and director of education of the Nader School of Pastry Arts in Orlando, Florida. You have produced this absolutely stunning book, Ewald. I've seen a lot of books on chocolate, but what sets this one aside?
Well, I was asked to write a textbook for schools, so I spent some time on research and I tried to find out how chocolate is made, where the cocoa beans come from. Some people want to know, some people are not interested in this, but it's always good to understand where it's from and how it's made, and then it goes into simply caramelizing nuts or roasting nuts, mixing in chocolate. Very easy, very simple, and tasting very good as well, and then into a simple ganaches, molded chocolate, slapped ganaches, and then further on into a decoration. I tried to explain how tall a decoration should be, where you get ideas, what color goes well, and what focus point, and so on. So it's a guideline from making chocolate into a decoration.
Now, you really think that people are going to be able to make these absolutely glorious sculptures that are at the end of the book?
I don't know.
That's a very honest man.
But it will help you to understand, and I try to explain how to come up with ideas and how to put it together. Simply how to cut out chocolate and how to make a flower. And I believe it's very well explained. It doesn't have to be like it is in the book, but it will give you a lot of ideas. And I have a lot of people writing me on the internet. There was a lot of mystery about chocolate, how to temper or how to put it together, and it helped them a lot. So it's not just for professionals. I think it has a lot for people which want to be chocolatiers or for hobbies. Then I think you can learn a lot from this and get a lot of ideas. Yeah.
I think it's also a wonderful book to have for someone who's on a diet, because they can look without having to taste. Now, it's a long way from Switzerland to Orlando, Florida, not exactly in a straight line, so fill in the blanks.
Well, I made an apprenticeship in Switzerland. It took 3 years, and I did the whole line of pastry, right? Pastry, chocolate, patisserie, cakes, and everything. But after the apprenticeship, I went into sugar decoration. Before chocolate, I did 10 years in sugar blowing, sugar casting, and pulling for 10 years, and opened the school, and was very, very busy. But after 10 years, I was so burned out. I just had it made with sugar. And then we moved to America, and I wanted to start with chocolate, work with chocolate like I used to do before. But it was a big frustration. I think I had it in my head, but I didn't have it in my fingers. I was very, very frustrated starting to work with chocolate, but this was good. I became very humble, and I had to think what I do, and it was also good to write the book, because I know how frustrated you can get.
Now, you're originally from Switzerland.
Yes.
And Switzerland has a fairly important place in the development of chocolate, as I recall from other people that we've talked to. Wasn't the Lindt, who had a lot to do with the modernization of the making of chocolate, wasn't he a fellow countryman of yours?
Yes, correct. And I think milk chocolate was developed in Switzerland with Nestle and Peter.
We'll all hate you for that.
I still, you know, there's no other country who eats as much chocolate per person as in Switzerland. It's unbelievable.
Okay, I think Peter's country, England, is a good rival.
I'm English, and I think we must be close behind.
Maybe, yeah. But I worked in England, too.
Oh, no. You did? Okay, yeah. Great.
Now, you've worked, you go into all kinds of chocolate here, but you really work mainly with milk chocolate. What do you think about this current involvement with the really dark, almost bitter chocolates?
Yes, I think it's okay. I still, you know, it's fact that milk chocolate, people like milk chocolate the most. But if you in the profession for a long time, or maybe it's age, people trying to go into dark chocolate, the bitter chocolate, all that they get. Kids like milk, that's a fact.
Oh, that's for sure.
But you grow out of this and you may like dark chocolate more. But yes, it's a trend. It's a trend, and I see that. But still here, I believe we sell a lot. No, I know we sell a lot more milk chocolate than dark chocolate. But dark chocolate is healthier, and it's good so.
Now, what is this Gianduja and marzipan praline section?
Marzipan, maybe not very popular here in America, but in Europe, France, Switzerland, Belgium, Germany, Italy, big part. Gianduja, Italy. Yes, it was developed in Italy. Gianduja. And Gianduja is roasted nuts, one part sugar, and one part chocolate. You grind it together, you mix it together, and it's a perfect praline filling because shelf life is very long. It doesn't have any cream in it or water, so it's perfect and it's smooth.
But the photograph, I mean, they're so absolutely gorgeous. I don't know where to look first.
You're on a diet, remember?
I mean.
But marzipan or gianduja, you can buy, you know, pre-made, finished. But I took the time and made it from step one, from the ingredients, took the ingredients and explained how it's made. And that's what we do here in the class as well, so it's very interesting. And even a gianduja, simple gianduja, you can change milk chocolate with dark chocolate, you can roast a lot more or less, you can give your own flavor, your own notes to it. I think that's important.
Now, did we already cover that Ewald is that your teacher in?
As well as a school.
You have your own school, okay.
Yes, we do.
How many students do you have?
Well, we have a small school at the moment. We may have altogether maybe 30 students, but I think we're growing. So we have, if I may say, a 6-month pastry program. It's called the European Pastry and Baking Program. But besides that, and I do this since 84, continued education, sugar decoration, chocolate decoration, and candy making, dessert. We have different kinds of 3-day classes. So I'm in education since a long, long time.
Well, no. Who comes to your school?
For the continuing education, mostly professional. People who work in the gastronomy, hotel, restaurant, or on ship. But to the 6-month program, a career changer, kids from college direct. So, and any age. We have any age, and it's very interesting.
I imagine it would be. I think it will open career paths to a lot of people.
Yes, it does. It does. And chocolate is very popular at the moment, especially in America. I can't believe what happened in the last 10 years.
Well, they claim that it's so healthy, you should do yourself a favor and eat it. But people have a gripe that they should only eat small amounts of it.
It is good for you, that's what they say. Yes, cocoa butter and especially dark chocolate. Milk chocolate, of course, has more sugar and milk powder in it, but it's proof. Yeah, dark chocolate is healthy.
Like everything we do, Americans overdo it.
It's good for me, yes.
Yes, I don't think you're going to be running out of students anytime soon. And probably now when you make all these, when the students make all these things, do they take them home or do you have an outlet where you sell them? I mean, it seems like such a shame that these would be created and then they wouldn't go anywhere.
We used to have an outlet, not right now, but soon we're going to have an outlet again.
Okay.
And the students, they take them home. They like it so much because you create something with your hands. You see what you do and you can taste it. And we can use, you know, I think it's one of the only professions you can use all your 5 senses. And it's really great and it's a joy to see them how they grow into chocolate. At the beginning, it's a mess, you know. I cannot say it differently. Sometimes it's a real mess. But you learn to work on it and what you get out of it, it's enormous.
And then you have the tremendous advantage. As long as you do it soon enough, you can eat it as well. So as the final treat, as you enjoy it for the very last time, you can consume it.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, in our profession, you make people happy, right?
Right.
Now, we met a wonderful sugar sculptress, I guess you would describe her.
Sculptress,
called Nora, originally from somewhere in
Colombia.
Colombia. She worked at a resort hotel close to here, and she used to make the most wonderful, wonderful things. But they really weren't edible. They were very pretty. They were very delicate. They were real sculptures, but they seemed to fall short in that.
Well, no, I mean, you only had the presentation pieces, which is all fondant.
Right.
Which is, you know, most fondant is for show rather than for eating.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
But his chocolate stuff, I mean, it's all there. You can eat the whole thing.
Well, do you put cardboard and stuff in the show pieces?
No, I'm completely against it. And I buy it too, and I disagree with a lot of competition today. For me, a show piece doesn't have to move. There's absolutely, there's no reason for it. I do a lot of chocolate sugar sculptures too. I did this more than chocolate, but there's two different things. Chocolate should be chocolate. There's so many different kinds of techniques. You can present chocolate. It doesn't need sugar, and sugar itself too. So I try not to mix it at all, and I will not use any cardboard or wire or styrofoam.
Yeah. No. That's wonderful, because I used to judge some chocolate show paste competitions with a pastry chef friend of mine, and I was appalled the first time she brought a pickaxe, you know, like you do with ice pick, and the first thing she did was she would just jam it into the base of the sculpture to see if there was any cardboard.
I didn't know to see if there was anything in it.
Yeah. I mean, it never occurred to me there would be. So, and these are patterns also here, right? In the back of your templates.
Yes, whatever I did. But some people like to create by themselves. I think it's very, very important that I explain the techniques well. Once you have all the techniques, I think creativity comes by itself. And if somebody's not so creative, I have the templates on the back, yes.
I have two questions, Ewan, before we sign off. First of all, people must be able to get in touch with you at the school. So if they're inquiring about knowing some more about the programs or just getting to know you better, how would they do that?
Well, you can Google or just come to notteschool.com. We have a website, notteschool.com.
Okay, good.
That's N-O-T-T-R.
N-O-T-T-E-R.
E-R. I missed the letter out.
Yes, N-O-T-T-E-R-S-C-H-O-O-L, notteschool.com. Or give us a call at 407-240-9057.
Now, I have another question to ask you.
Yeah.
Don't you think this is the most beautiful textbook you've ever seen in your whole life? you said you set out to write a textbooks like this book.
I'm so happy people like it, because it was a lot of work to do it.
Sure.
Once you finish your work, you're always very critical. So am I. I'm critical too. There's other things I like to change, but overall, I'm very happy. I'm very happy. I did it
Photograph of you also in the cover.
Yeah, I have a lot of makeup on.
Listeners, this man is way too modest. This is an absolutely magnificent book. If you love chocolate, whether or not you want to go to school to study it further, you need a copy of this book on your, I guess we should call it, chocolate table rather than coffee table.
Right. We better give the title, because I don't think we did that.
It's called
The Art of the Chocolatier. From Classic Confections to Sensational Showpieces, and that it is. And it's Ewald, E-W-A-L-D, Notter, N-O-T-T-E-R. And thank you, Ewald. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, so there we have it. Are you going to go rushing out tempering chocolate?
Well, I'm sure you are. And I'm sure you're going to line up and get Gabrielle Hamilton's book. If you live in or near Pittsburgh, you're going to line up at NOLA on the square. And you also know more about
Ramsey.
Gordon Ramsay than perhaps you ever needed to know. But certainly I think you
Marcus
know.
Marcus is such
you know
a
that,
nice guy.
Yeah, and Marcus is running a fine restaurant in New York, and sounds like that chef's table in the middle of the kitchen is just fantastic.
Yeah, I want to do that.
Yeah, we're going to see if we can't get in there somehow or other. Anyway,
okay.
We'll see you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.